Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
I wanted to write a song about this in the style of Jimmy Driftwood singing Tennessee Stud, but just too complicated, okay? So can I just tell you what happened? Long about 2021, Kamala Harris put her Bigfoot in her mouth, jammed them in there sideways, and saved President Joe Biden from big trouble. She's like a loyal robot, like a pinata robot, blowing herself up and giving Republicans a stick to thwack her good to distract them from when Joe steps in it. And he stepped in it good with his son, the former crackhead, China-Ukraine business tycoon, now selling his artwork to anybody with big bucks. Yes, Hunter Biden, the president's son, is a budding artist, and he's selling his artwork. Is that water lilies or perhaps self-portraits with a crack pipe and the stripper pole? I don't know. But imagine if a judge did that. What if a judge's wife sold her artwork to lawyers who may or may not find themselves working cases before that judge? You know what will happen? Somebody might get indicted. What if a Chicago alderman did that? She trotted out her own husband to sell her his own artwork. Perhaps handcrafted ashtrays for $5,000 to business owners who might want to open a weed shop on the corner or an all-night liquor store. And we couldn't know. That's what they're doing in Washington. How Chicago way is the Biden family anyway? I know. Rather than speculate, let's just ask Granny. Granny, what do you think?
You know what I say?
What's that?
I say that big talk's worth doodly squat.
Doodly squat? Well, maybe. But Granny, what was Kamala Harris doing talking about how rural people can't find a Kinko's to copy their voter ID? Rural voters, that means country people, living outside the cities, outside the precincts of the Chardonnay Antifa, people that live on the land and grow our food and know how to skin possums, I suspect. They want voter ID to protect the integrity of the vote. They don't mind voter ID. Anyway, just as the Hunter Biden art story began to overshadow the Hunter Biden laptop story that everyone ignored in the mainstream media, here comes Kamala Harris opening her big mouth and sticking both feet in sideways. And while she tastes her shoes, you know what happened? The rest of us forgot any of that 25th Amendment talk about Joe's cognitive decline. Genius. Pure genius.
I don't think that we should underestimate what that could mean. Because in some people's mind, that means, well, you're going to have to Xerox or photocopy your ID to send it in to prove you are who you are. Well, there are a whole lot of people, especially people who live in rural communities, who don't. There's no Kinko's. There's no Office Max near them. People have to understand that when we're talking about voter ID laws, be clear about who you have in mind and what would be required of them to prove who they are. Of course, people have to prove who they are, but not in a way that makes it almost impossible for them to prove who they are.
And then comes J.D. Vance, the Ivy League author of Hillbilly Elegy, a brilliant book on his growing up in Appalachia in the Ohio Hill Country. And he's now a public intellectual running for the Senate as a Republican from Ohio. J.D. Vance sure took Harris down a peg.
We have all kinds of crazy things in small towns in the state of Ohio and across the country. We've got electricity, we've got running water, and we even have soap. And it's amazing that the Vice President of the United States thinks that people can't make photocopies in rural communities. I mean, it's like she thinks that if you go to a small town in this country, You've got the Tractor Supply store. You've got the guys with the dueling banjos, and there's nothing else there. And, of course, that's ridiculous. And anybody who lives in these communities or spent time in them knows that.
Yes, of course she's ridiculous. She's the worst politician in the world. I did like the dueling banjos part. But she sure saves Joe's bacon, doesn't she? Anyway, I don't even know what that means. How do you save someone's bacon? What's the root of it? I don't really care. The thing is, she's a clown, but she's a crafty clown. So what do we have for you today on the Chicago Way podcast besides a few references to that new website where you can find me at johncastnews.com? Well, we've got Liam, T-A-F-X Ford. And if you figure out what that means, maybe we'll give you a prize. Liam is a longtime Tribune editor, my dearest friend, former city news reporter at City Hall. That's how we met. And years later, Mr. Ford became the legendary Slim the Leg Man. He was given that nickname not by me, but by our boss at the time, managing editor, later editor, Anne Marie Lipinski. She looked him up and down and said, "You're Slim. Slim the Leg Man." And that's how it happened. Now, maybe I'll bring up how Slim pleaded and whined himself out of having to cover a story about the outfit. Or what about the time Liam and I went hunting for Joey the Clown Lombardo at a West Side restaurant the night that the mob's top cop was indicted? It was a neighborhood place, you know, a place where everyone minds their business, and it was perfect for our purpose. Liam is a thoughtful man with a meticulous, encyclopedic knowledge of the city, and he's also a beekeeper. Another person who loves bees is Jeff Carlin, and he's here. Jeff is executive producer at WGN Radio and co-host here as always. He's a master baker and a master of sound. And if we sound halfway decent, it's because Jeff Carlin has made it so. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, mild-mannered columnist. You can find me these days at johncassnews.com. Sign up and subscribe and tell your friends. And tell them about this podcast. Subscription is free. And please give us a 5-star review. We'll love you forever. And if you don't want to do that, well, pretend I never said anything. And where are you with Granny talking about Doodly Squad and Vice President Harris talking about rural people sticking her feet in her mouth? And with Hunter Biden selling artwork just like a judge. Just like a county judge. Where are you? You're on the Chicago Way. On WGN Plus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
Local media all over the country is imploding. There are various reasons for this, about the economic model, also the population of the newsrooms. Some of them are quite woke. One who might give us some insight is a man who's just left the Tribune, Liam Thomas Aquinas Francis Xavier Ford, known to my readers as Slim the Leg Man, who has spent years as an editor on the breaking news section, should have been on the editorial board, and almost was, but lack of bad planning by senior management allowed that to happen. He's now left the Tribune. He's a father, a husband, Roman Catholic, I'd say conservative, now with myself and Kristen McQuarrie and Liam gone, then there are really none. Welcome to the Chicago Way, Liam.
Thank you very much, John. Good morning.
Good morning.
So,
what are you doing now, Liam? I mean, I love the stories of people getting into their books and music, and now that they've left the Tribune. But I know, and we will get to it, but I can't wait to talk about bees. I just can't. I love
it. Well, there you go. I'm one of the things that's happened with me. John mentioned that I'm a Roman Catholic. And one of the things that has happened with me is that I've become much more involved in my parish in the last few years. And our last mass is for the parish is actually on August 31st. So I've been doing a lot of volunteer work there, trying to keep our food pantry going after the parish closes, and work on some other stuff. And of course, I've been applying to jobs and working on starting to work on a project that I had been thinking about for a long time, about public information and government secrecy, and just trying to walk a little more and sleep a little more now that I'm not getting up at 5:30 every morning to start the Tribune's coronavirus blog.
Those of you listening should know that Liam was city news trained. And while that might not seem a big deal to many, it is to me, and it is to everyone who's in the business. City News, the famous training ground for journalists, where you get the phrase or slogan, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. I'm wondering now, Liam, with your new life, you don't have to be you're not on the phone anguishing over someone calling it Boulevard rather than street or avenue, which I know drove you insane.
Yes, well, John, you once said that you hired me as your leg man because I'm a nebbish for accuracy. And I do have to say, one of the things about, I was thinking about this, I got a message from another former breaking news desk person this morning. One of the things that City News did for me that sometimes you don't see enough of in newsrooms, because partly because of lack of staff, but just because of the way that the culture is, there was a large degree of training by somewhat more senior reporters at City News of less senior reporters, and was formalized in a lot of ways. Everybody had a how-to on their beat, and they had lists of phone numbers that they would pass on to you. And it was expected that you would work with other people and do your work collaboratively. And I'm not saying that the Tribune was not that way. I learned a lot from other reporters and editors, including yourself and many of the people who've left recently, but also many who have left in the last 15 years. But I do think that a lot of young people don't benefit from enough of that formalized training at news organizations, partly because of how much institutional memory has been lost in the last few years in places like the Tribune, when I started and when you started, there were a lot of people who'd been there for many years. And if you were working on something with them, they would explain things to you, like how property taxes work and
the tax multiplier.
The tax multiplier, how the tax increment financing, the pot of gold that the city of Chicago has had for developers for years works. And
why is it Pulaski Road instead of Crawford? Yeah, all that. But you know what?
there was at City News, and I wasn't lucky enough to have been trained there by, I guess in my time, it would have been by the great Paul Zimbrakis and Joe Riley. But there was a certain, I noticed this from watching you and others at City Hall when I was the City Hall reporter and right near the City News desk, that there was a certain relentless, almost aggressive training of by senior writers or senior reporters. And by senior, I mean people who were like 26.
Right, instead of 24, exactly.
Right, except for the 23-year-olds. And there was not really a lot of concern about feelings or how you feel. There wasn't a lot of hand-holding. It was, this is what we do, and this is where how we do it. And if you don't like how we're doing it, get out. There was a certain, it was almost like an esprit de corps.
Yes, and I think that, we went through, we covered together people like John Chase and Dion Searcy and my wife Ann Weiler and I. We covered horrible, horrible things during our time. Like one of the stories that we all three were involved in was the horrible story involving Yemi Sandifer, 11-year-old boy who killed a slightly older teenager and later was killed by, himself. And, you know, that's...
10-year-old hitman.
Right. And, when you go through experiences like that with other people, you do form a bond. But it also, you have to, there's the pressure to get things right and to be, to be respectful of the people who are involved too. That's one of the reporters and editors, well, one of the reporters who I started out my career trying to emulate was a Miami Herald crime reporter named Edna Buchanan, who always tried to humanize and be respectful of the people who she wrote about and made the point that when you're writing about a murder victim, there may be no other point at which anybody tells that person's story for the public. And I think that attitude about reporting can be broadened to almost any type of reporting. You know, you are trying to get out there to other people the stories of people who might never have any contact with the public, but whose lives can benefit from the exposure that you can give them, or just a story that other people can benefit from thinking about. And that's, you know, that's your job as a reporter, is to tell the stories of the society around you and let other people know what's going on, whether it's somebody spending a lot of time earning a lot of money from a city hall, a city council committee, when they're actually spending their days lounging at home, or whether
what?
It's
how about having a gun and having a bag of cocaine at the Four Seasons hotel, and you brandish your gun and then you get arrested, and then at the 18th district here comes the alderman from the 36th ward talking to the captain, getting you out of it. It's funny how that happens.
I know. It's just so unfortunate.
We have to tell the story. I know we want to get into the difficulties of local media and your recent tweets on the subject, because as you left the Tribune, you posted, I think, on Twitter.
Yes.
An important examination, but also, remember, Jeff, that Liam Ford was my first leg man. Anne-Marie Lipinski gave him his first nickname. She said he's slim. He's slim, so call him Slim.
Very fitting.
And there was Michael Kortz and I have to go here, Liam. Michael Kortz and Mark Brown at the Sun-Times had written a story about Fifi Bucchieri, the hitman, and said, basically, if I'm not mistaken, they said in those days that he was, they alleged he was gay or something like that. Right, Liam, do I have this
yes,
correctly?
Yes, yes. They said that unknown to a number of people, he was gay. And you asked me to go out to West Grand Avenue and just randomly go into a few bars and ask people about the gay mobster lifestyle. And, while I've been in my life as a reporter, I have stood on the doorstep where people were shot to death and interviewed the murderers who shot them to death. I was having growing up in Chicago with a lot of contact with the near west suburbs, since I lived on the far west side, I was somewhat reluctant to do that. So
you wind your way out of it. You said, no, I can't go. I'm not going to go to Lascaroll and ask them about that at the bar.
That's true. I did wind my way out of it, but
and I let you get out of it. But we did end up once. I thought a significant point. There was the indictment of the chief of detectives of the Chicago Police Department, Bill Hanhart, mm-hmm. indicted for yes. running the mob's national jewelry theft ring, which is nice since he was really the de facto police superintendent for years, the mob's guy, Bill Hanhart. And we went to La Bella Notte because one of my sources, not in the Boy Scouts, but the other scouts on the dark side, called me and said, the old man was at Bella Notte. And we should ask him about Hanhart. So Liam and I, those days, you know, there was an expense account, so I didn't have to pick up all the dinners, went on a reporting mission to a very good Italian restaurant on the West Side. What happened, Liam? Do you remember?
Well, I remember that. I don't remember the whole evening in every detail, but I do remember us going in and getting a table and there being a conversation with the waiter or the maitre d' about a gentleman who was at the other side of the restaurant and
Joe Lombardo.
Yes, and we were told that he was someone else, our judgment was that he was wearing a religious medal, that
Saint Dismas, the good yes, thief.
Yes, and he had been identified by the waiter. He was identified by the waiter, I believe it was, who was Jewish rather than Italian. But
we asked the guy, we asked the maitre d'. I said, okay. Because I took out you had your back to all this. We were seated at the side of the restaurant.
Right.
And you were craning your neck to try to see, and I see Lombardo across the way. And I take out slowly, you know, because Lombardo was the guy who was the street boss for the outfit and gave Hanhart his instructions at the Chicago Police Department. So I took out my notepad and held it in the air, like as you would if you're going to approach a vicious dog in a behind the fence. You don't want to startle it. Even though he was an old man, he was still Joey Lombardo. So as soon as I did that, he snapped his fingers and all the busboys in the place came and scooped his food into to-go cups or cartons. He ran out of the restaurant, his St. Dismas medal, the good thief that was next to, crucified next to Jesus, was around his neck, visible. And the maitre d' said, I said, well, what's with Joe Lombardo? And Liam's like, yeah, what's with Joe Lombardo? Why'd he leave? And he said, the maitre d' went through his list of credit card receipts and said, no, no, you're mistaken. That wasn't, I don't know who Joe Lombardo is. I don't know.
Right.
That was Dr. Goldstein.
Yes, that's right. That was it.
Dr. Goldstein, fantastic. Yeah. My ass, Dr. Goldstein. No offense, Dr. Goldstein, but it wasn't you weren't Joe Lombardo.
No. No.
That's fantastic. I mean, you guys, I always imagine, Liam, and tell me if I'm wrong, but like John is the quarterback in kind of these situations, and you're the like nose guard kind of, and like you guys go out into the streets together. You know, John sees the play and you execute, or how did the dynamic between you, what was that like?
I think it was a partnership, but go ahead.
Yeah, I would say it was a partnership. I mean, often, you know, there would be a few situations where I would lay the groundwork and John would go out and do some of the one-on-one interviews himself. But in many cases, we would go and interview people together. There was John did a series of articles, starting when he was with when I was with him, but then continuing until this case wrapped up regarding a shoemaker in my neighborhood in Rogers Park who was murdered, and we're able to get in touch with the family. We attended the wake.
Yonya Feldman.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yonya Feldman, and spoke to the family, and then followed up John. And for several of the initial articles, we worked very closely together, and then for the final for one of the final interviews, John went and interviewed his widow by himself. But most of the time, we were working together. Like we went to the wake together, and we went to the neighborhood together, and I did some of the research, and so it was very much a collaboration when we were working together.
Liam, I'd forgotten. You know, I just wrote a piece just now about Lightfoot and Arnie Duncan, you know, being positioned to run against her, mm-hmm. and how we forget the names of the dead. And I had forgotten Mr. Feldman.
He's never far from my mind. Yeah. He's never far from my mind because it was a neighborhood, because he was a neighborhood institution, and it's still my neighborhood, 20 years later. So, but yes, it's something that that I feel like I'm most proud of in my time at the Tribune was pressing us to pay attention to and consider those affected by, you know, violence in the city.
So what's happened? I know Jeff wants to get into other subjects, and we will. I'm sorry, I won't manipulate your time. You're no longer working for me, and you haven't for 20 years. But what's happened to local media?
There's a lot of things that have happened to local media, and I think the primary issue is economic and the lack of ability to or vision to respond to all the changes that have happened in the last 25 years. There are a lot of ancillary issues. You know, you and I, John, we come from backgrounds that are different from a lot of reporters and editors who we knew in the Tribune newsroom. No fault of theirs, but you know, you came from a very working class background. I came, you know, when I was know, in my by in, into my teens, my dad was a janitor for the Board of Education, and you know, I spent a one of the reasons that I mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, I'm fighting to save my parish food pantry. One of the reasons is that when I was a child, I spent a lot of time helping my dad get food from a food pantry in the neighboring village of a park. And
you still hate Velveeta to this day.
I have to say, the government cheese you get is a lot better than Velveeta.
But you grew up on the West Side. You were a white kid growing in a white family, growing up in Austin that had already undergone tremendous change. But your dad could afford that place, and so you guys held on to it.
Raised
a big Irish family.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of you went on to top flight universities, Harvard for you and others.
Yeah. Yeah, I have two siblings who went to Columbia in New York, and everybody else has a degree of one type or another. I have a brother with a PhD in English.
Scrabble games must be intimidating.
Yes, and another brother with a PhD in international relations. So it's fun when we get together. But you know, getting back to the newsrooms, I think that. I think in many cases, if you want to characterize it generally, I think it's a lack of imagination coupled with the economic forces. So, if you you talked about woke, I have to say that from my perspective, looking at how things, I'm not a minority reporter. I'm not somebody who has had to deal with the types of discrimination that I know some of my colleagues have had to deal with. But I do know that if you're a young person in media and you have talent, and the editors don't understand your point of view and your way of looking at the world, you're going to leave, and you're going to go find something better. And, with fewer and fewer resources, young people are supported less, and they're more likely to leave, and that makes it harder to retain any type of talent, but especially people who, like myself, you know, when I went to college, there were a lot of things I didn't understand about, you know, how to keep a budget, keep from like going into credit card debt, how to pay. I didn't know how to pay off a loan. All these things that seem like they're common sense to people who are upper middle class are not necessarily things that a new reporter from a less privileged background is going to be able to deal with. And, you know, newspapers are not set up to the Tribune and other places have tried to be set up to be environments for people who could broaden our perspectives, but they haven't done a good job of it. And you know, I'm not in the position that the reporters that minority reporters have been in, but you know, I can see that there are legitimate complaints.
So. I wouldn't disagree. I think that in the old days, when I came in, almost 40 years ago, a newspaper like the Tribune was almost like a university, and you were helped along various ways by older, wiser colleagues. some of whom were, you know, would scream at the top of their lungs, "Cass, grow the bleep up," but they were still wise, and others were kind and supportive. And I think that with the shrinking, the revenue model shrinking and losing those kinds of people throughout the newsroom, that hurt the younger reporters, particularly those minority reporters who were coming into a largely white, liberal environment, but they still felt that they weren't appreciated or welcomed. And I don't think this is, or not welcomed, but nurtured.
Right.
And I don't think this is inconsistent with all other newsrooms in the country. And so when you get that kind of dislocation, at the same time you have a pressing, pushing political ideology coming out of the universities, and this one now of the left, maybe in the 50s it was of the right, but now it's of the left, you get disastrous results, I think.
I think you can get bad results, but, you know, I think that there's a way to, I think there's a way for strong newsroom leadership to take this moment in the news business and examine how what we cover and how we cover it and use it as an opportunity because if you look at what's been going on at the Tribune particularly, there's been some great work done by some of the younger reporters, particularly Laura Rodriguez Presa, for example, who's been covering the Latino community over the last couple of years after we unfortunately closed OI. And you know, if the Tribune is able to assign reporters to cover neighborhoods the way that she does, then I think we would be able to. Then here I am saying we. It's not we anymore, John.
That's right. You're out of it. But I do think.
I think the paper is trying to do that better and cover the communities that the paper has not spent a good deal of its history not covering in the way that they deserve. And I think if news organizations take this moment in media and in the culture to say, we're going to cover aspects of American society that we have not covered before, then I think that there can be good results.
Did you feel like there's been a move away from quality towards quantity? I mean, on the inside, was there a over the last 20 some years, was there a push more like that feeling like that you just had to be out and hit everything, a spray shot versus, I don't know, a targeted attack? I hate to say that, but that's kind of what I'm looking for or feeling from newspapers.
You know, I have to say that it's funny. I have a friend who used to be, was a friend of my father's, who was a long time ago, before John even worked there, the publisher of the Daily Calumet, and which was a newspaper on the southeast side of Chicago.
The oldest community daily in America.
There you go. That subsequently was bought by the Southtown. And I always have an issue with quality versus quantity. I mean, if you look at newspapers, in decades past, there was a lot more quantity in among the quality. And I think that you don't need to sacrifice those. I think excuse me, for example, beat reporters can do a number of shorter stories in a week, and then a weekend story and an investigative story. And I think that you just, there's so much news out there. You need to often be often need to be covering both developing day-to-day stories and having those enterprise stories, those sometimes not even investigative stories, but stories that reporters come up with on their own or cover a topic that needs more in-depth coverage.
Jeff, here's what pissed me off for years, and it started years and years ago. Say Liam and Jeff and John would, or Liam and John would spend, would take time to write an investigative piece or a explainer of some kind. It would take some time to do. And then it would land with a, you know, loud bang in the paper, and people would react to it. And instead of Liam and myself getting the reaction, often there was a culture in the papers, to in all papers, not just the one I left, to have other reporters, younger reporters, go out and get the supporting quotes for reaction stories. And that always frosted me. I was always like, well, hey, you guys did the stories.
Right.
Why don't you go out there and get the quotes?
Right.
You know the story better than I do.
And to be fair, John, you know, people like Gary Marks and David Jackson and a number of our colleagues and
the best,
a lot of other reporters who I've known who are so-called are known as investigative reporters wanted to do those daily follow-ups.
Yes.
And
did John Chase and all those guys. Yeah, Kidwell, all of them. But some didn't. And it wasn't the reporters. It was editors.
Right, it was the culture.
It was the culture. And there was another thing. Jeff, you asked about quantity over quality. You have a big story. Say it's of, let's just say hypothetically, the mayor's idiot nephew is investing on the Olympic footprint with public money from the unions, okay, in real estate. Let's just say hypothetically. Do you wait and do a huge story that takes months, or do you do short story after short story, or even if you have all the information, do you let it out at once, or do you do it piece by piece by piece, like A, coming tomorrow?
Right. There's something B. to be said for the broad story that explains everything. But then there's also something to providing a narrative that keeps the reader coming, not only keeps the reader coming back, but shows them how your understanding of the subject evolved their understanding of the subject evolves.
That helped, Jeff.
Well, that helps, John. I appreciate that. I mean, that's kind of what I always felt was going on. But before we let Liam go, I got to ask, everyone who's lamented and you leaving is also lamenting the bees. Are the bees going to be okay with you around all the time? Is it too much, Liam, for your bees? And real quickly, how many bees do you have? Give us a quick rundown on your bees.
Both the hives right now are doing really well. So they're probably in the one of the hives is probably in the 40,000 bees range, and the other one's probably about 35,000 bees. And I actually have not taken time yet this week to check them. They need a little more space, but they have enough space for themselves, but I need to put some more what are known as supers, which are the boxes that the beekeeper gets the honey from.
Where did you start this? You started this in Austin on the West Side when you were a kid, right?
Yes, I did. I had a neighbor who was a I had a neighbor who kept bees, who had a very large property. But then the guy who really actually set me up was Dr. Bill Fitzsimmons, who was a West Suburban doctor who had been in World, who had been in the Army Air Force in World War II, flown a lot over Africa. But he kept bees in, he lived in Oak Park, so he couldn't keep bees because it was illegal there. So he had beehives in the far western suburbs, I think DeKalb and then downstate. And when I was 11, I started, he started teaching me how to keep bees. I got a hive that I kept on my neighbor's property. And for a short time, for a few years, actually, I was on the list and for swarm catchers for the village of River Forest. and went one time I went and caught a swarm there and put it in a box and walked it back home in a grocery cart. So, because my parents, neither of them ever learned to drive, and so we had no car. So I had to walk the, I had to bring the swarm of bees home, in a box in one of those like old lady grocery carts.
That's amazing. How do you catch a swarm of bees?
You find the queen, and then you find the queen by like trying to find the center of the swarm. You put your hands in the swarm and like move the bees aside. They are very, they very rarely sting during a swarming. And you catch the queen, put her in a cage or just put her in and put the cage in a box or a hive and shake the if you can shake the bees into the box and just leave it for a few little bit and they'll all collect around the queen because they're driven by her pheromones. So
that's awesome.
Because there's nothing like sticking your hands in a swarm of bees with,
there is nothing like sticking your hands in, hand in a swarm of bees. It's one of the most exhilarating feelings in the world. It is great to be able to do it. And yes, you also hired me because I'm eccentric, John.
You are eccentric, but I did get a chance to don the beak, the aviarist's or whatever it is. What is it?
Yes. Yes. Apiarist.
Apiarist's costume. And, but you know what? And to look for honey with Liam, but here's the thing for Liam and Jeff, Jeff is a great baker. And I think I've only had one slice of his pie.
You've had two slices, John.
Two slices in all these years?
I brought pie to your house once.
Yes, but it was so good, everyone ate it. I just got a little crust. And then the other thing, Liam, all those bees and honey, H-U-N-Y, and I'm Eeyore, sitting outside glumly while watching Pooh eat all the honey. Guess what? Where's my honey? You know what? I think I got maybe 1 4-ounce jar of honey. He presented it to me as if we were in some oriental splendor, like in like Iraq in the 18th century. And he offered it to me like, you know, with both hands.
Well, hopefully we will get more this year and get more to you. So,
okay, Liam, thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks, Liam.
Thanks.
Appreciate Take it. Care, Hope guys. You come back. Hope you return. Yes. For Liam Ford, my friend, longtime Tribune editor, former leg man of mine when he was called Slim, and he still is. And there was a contest we ran if people could figure out that his full name, which was his initials are L T A I can't. It's Liam Thomas Aquinas Francis Xavier Ford. And I don't know, somebody got a couple cheeseburgers out of it. So for Liam Ford, formerly of the Tribune, beekeeper, on to great things. And I hope he'll come back. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer at WGN Radio, excellent baker, and promised, as you heard just now, that he will bake me a pie so I can have a slice, even though Betty won't probably let me. And to all of you,
I'll get it to you,
Jim. You'll get it to me. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, columnist at johncassnews.com. Thank you for joining us on the Chicago Way. We'll see you again next time, okay?